Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Born and raised in L.A., Stevie Ray Hernandez is one of the most sought-after young percussionists in Hollywood. His credits read like a list of dream gigs, performing with the Philharmonic Orchestra under Gustavo Dudamel and John Williams. He's also played with the Golden State Pops Orchestra, and artists such as Dionne Warwick, Robin Thicke, Kelly Clarkson, John Legend, Michael Bublé, Daddy Yankee, Luis Fonsi, Sarah Bareilles, Johnny Mathis, whom I've also played with, Reggie Watts, Tyga, Kid Cudi, Camila Cabello, and Kanye West. Yes, he's got his hands in every genre, and I love that about Stevie. You can also catch him playing on TV shows like The Late Late Show with James Corden, American Idol, The Voice, America's Got Talent, Dancing with the Stars, X Factor, and The Mandalorian. Check out how Stevie Ray Hernandez has created such a high demand for his work right here only on the Career Musician Podcast. Stevie Ray Hernandez, welcome to the Career Musician Podcast, my friend.
Yeah, man, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, no introduction is necessary to your boy Eric G here.
What up?
Sorry, man.
And I'm really glad for that Eric connected us. Thank you, Eric G, for that.
Yep.
He was telling me about some of your shenanigans growing up in the scene, and sounds like you guys had a blast.
Yeah, I met Eric, I met you, was it late high school or college? I think it was college, right?
We met in college.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of mutual friends because we were friends with the Gahate family. So, our close mutual friend was Tristan Gahate and Roland Gahate. So, we got to know each other through those peeps and, like, we ended up bonding over Latin music because of that.
Right. Yeah, I love that. I love that Eric is a huge proponent of Latin music everywhere he goes. He's like, yo, Latinos, I love it.
Actually, Stevie is one of my go-to drummers for any genre.
Oh, I love that.
If I need a jazz trio, I call Stevie. If I need, timbales for a salsa band, I call Stevie. He's the guy, man.
Bro, it's awesome. And that's just testament to the fact that you've honed your versatility. That's so important, right?
Going to CSUN, or Cal State Northridge, like the teacher that I had there was very big on like learning how to do a lot of different things as opposed to just like sticking to one thing, like just being a jazz drummer or just being a classical musician.
Right.
So I learned how to do a lot of different things. Like I studied, my main thing there was classical music, but I was also in like some of the jazz combos and like the Latin band going there, So I got to experience a lot of different styles of music going to CSUN. And that's why I was like really fortunate and really grateful for that school because it taught me the value of like learning a lot of different things. Especially like in Los Angeles, because it's really valuable to know a lot of different styles of music as opposed to just like sticking to one thing.
Right. Man, I couldn't agree more. I've had the same experience going to a good music school, and I know Eric has, and obviously so many of us in the business. That is the thing. And you know what? There's nothing like a great music teacher who speaks into your life. It's just... Mm-hmm. Right? You can't put a price tag on that. I mean, I hate to sound like a commercial, but it's true.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to have the teachers that I had there. One of the main guys was a guy named Jerry, and he passed away, but he made me understand like the value of like being versatile,
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the fact that your background is in classical, which tells me that you're a great reader. And you also understand dynamics really well. Mm-hmm. I've had the pleasure of working with some orchestras and modern ensembles combined. And one of the biggest things is, you know, you always have to tell the drummer, hey, man, you better watch the conductor and pay attention to, you know, the dynamics that are happening in the moment, because if you just start blaring away, you're going to kill the whole thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very different thing playing drum set in an orchestra as opposed to playing like a rock band or a pop band. Yeah, like you said, like always watching the conductor and keeping in mind like the dynamics that are going on.
Absolutely.
But I remember the first time I was in college, the first time I ever played drums with an orchestra. And I was like, this is totally weird. I don't understand how to do this.
Yeah.
Because I was just so used to being in like a garage rock band, just like, wailing on the drum.
Right.
But then you had to like look at your music and look at the conductor and make sure you're playing the right dynamic. And sometimes the strings are like way behind you, but you got to like stay solid. And, you know, it's your job to like be the rock that everyone anchors onto in the group.
Man, that's so true. And, you know, the strings by nature have a latency in attack. That's just the nature of the instrument, right? Whereas like the brass is always right on the one usually, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the drummers, you guys have to hold the pocket down. It's tough, man. I can definitely relate to that. Talk about, you know, also playing in the percussion section of an orchestra, because, bro, your credits are beautiful. L.A. Phil, Golden State Pops, John Williams. I mean, the list goes on. You know, I think that's an excellent foundation to build upon.
Yeah, I mean, playing in a percussion section is different than being like a Latin percussionist, because you're always adjusting to the time. So like in an orchestra, like the time's kind of fluid. So that was always the biggest challenge for me as a section percussionist in an orchestra, especially like playing at a venue like the Hollywood Bowl, because everyone's so spread out and you're in this giant, it's almost like you're in a barn and you can't, like the strings are like 50 feet away from you and you can't even hear what they're playing, but you got to play with them. So it's definitely like a very like unique experience, like getting used to listening to the group and learning how to play with them. But my favorite is like when they have a click track, because then I don't have to worry about that as much.
Yeah.
The last concerts I did at the Bowl, the last one I did was Coco.
Oh.
And everyone was on click track. So that was awesome.
You were working with Jermaine Franco, my buddy.
Well, what did he do?
Was she there? She was part of the composer for that score.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She worked with John Powell for years, and then she's branched out and she's, you know, composing her own stuff. What a sweetheart and such a talented composer. I'm guessing she was there maybe, but you know, I guess you just didn't meet her that night.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many people there. It was like hundreds of people on that stage.
Isn't it crazy when you do orchestra dates, literally hundreds of people?
Yeah, I mean, the orchestra stuff, like, it's kind of like being in high school. There's like cliques, like, and people like stick to their cliques. So like, there will be gigs where like, I'm like, wow, I gigged with you and I never even knew that. Like, I've played with this person like 20 times and I've maybe said hi to them like once.
That's so funny. Eric and I were just talking about that.
Dude, there's actually a story of when you and I were on the same soundstage and we didn't even know it until later on the day.
That's right.
When I was teaching and I brought my choir to come sing for you guys with Alan Menken.
Yeah, that's right. And then I posted on Instagram.
And I was in the picture.
And you guys didn't even know it that day?
We didn't know we would have said hi.
Wow. We had no idea.
That just goes to show you what big productions are like, you know? You know, and that's something cool to tell the listeners maybe who haven't experienced it yet. You know, a big production is quite the feat to pull off, obviously, you know, pre-pandemic and post-pandemic. We'll get back to it, I believe. But there's so many moving parts and logistics that are involved.
Yeah, like Coco, for instance, there was one night of rehearsal. We did like a 3-hour rehearsal and we played the same song for 2 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, just because they wanted to get all the staging right. So it was funny by the time, because they did the show for Disney Plus.
Right.
So they did all these extra songs for Disney Plus, aside from the actual movie.
Right.
So Disney was more concerned with the extra songs than with the actual movie score.
Mm.
So they rehearsed the heck out of like these like 5 songs. And then the movie score, by the time we got to the actual show, we only ran the movie score in entirety, like maybe 1 time. So everyone was just like on edge, like we're like, how is this gonna go? All right, let's go for it.
Wow. And that's something to be said about that too. I feel like sometimes when as a professional musician, sometimes when there's no rehearsal involved or very little rehearsal, it puts us almost in a better headspace. Like we just know that we can't fuck up. So like our focus is supreme, mm-hmm. right? You know?
Yeah. I mean,
hyper-focus.
I do remember being like hyper-focused during that performance. I mean, there was 2 shows. Yeah. So the second one, we were all a little bit more relaxed because we were like, all right, last night went okay. So
right,
we got this one now.
Right. What's your favorite instrument in the percussion section of an orchestra? What's your favorite instrument to play?
Probably the timpani.
Nice.
Yeah. Just because they have like the most power.
Right.
It's like being... They're like timbales.
Yeah.
Giant ones.
Yeah. That too. I could go on the side.
You know? I do a little cascara on the side of the timpani. That's nice.
Well, that's where timbales come from. The history comes from timpani.
See, look at that.
Yeah.
Love that.
I think in the Caribbean, they saw the European orchestras and they had kettle drums, and so they copied them.
Wow. How cool is that? What I wonder what time period that initially took place. Do you guys know?
Yeah. Maybe like 1700s, 1800s.
Wow.
When we were getting crossover from Africa.
Right. That's incredible. I love the history of the music and, you know, and how it's really, I mean, geez, it's so horrible. But if we didn't have the African slaves come over, we wouldn't have the incredible music that we have today, right? It's like, it's a mind-boggling thing to actually contemplate, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so much great music came from that continent. Like,
right.
It's incredible when you think about it. Like you said, like, the stuff that went to Brazil and
right.
the Caribbean and Peru. Yeah. And
right. And Cuba and Puerto Rico. I mean, all the islands. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. So, and speaking of that, tell us a little bit about your heritage.
I mean, I'm a Mexican kid from the Valley.
Nice. Nice.
But yeah, my great grandparents, I think on both sides came from Mexico.
Okay.
So by the time they got to my generation, I was pretty Americanized.
Mm.
But my dad was very like East LA Chicano. And my mom was just like Valley Mexican chick, you know? But like I got to experience a lot of different music growing up because of my dad.
I was going to say that. What inspired you musically? And when did the bug bite you, you know?
I remember specifically when the bug bit me. It was... My grandma gave me a Walkman. This was in the 90s. Remember those things?
I used to have several Walkmans, yeah.
And she gave me one for Christmas. And I didn't know what to listen to. And I think it was like, I was in like third grade at the time, and all the kids around me were listening to like Dr. Dre and Snoop, because that was like the new thing.
Sure.
And I was just like, I wasn't into it. So I remember like walking in my neighborhood, or like being close to like my neighborhood, and seeing a sign, a billboard that said K-Earth 101. And I was like, what the heck's K-Earth 101? So I dialed that in on the radio, and it was just like the oldie station. So it was like all Motown and like 50s music and Beatles. And like, that was when the bug bit me, when I heard like Motown and the Beatles. I was like, oh man, this is the shit.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't get enough of it. Like, I became such a diehard Beatles fan, like when I was like 9 years old. Like, I got all the records, got, I mean, CDs were big at the time, so I got like all the CDs going. My dad had a vinyl collection. I started pulling out like Marvin Gaye,
yes,
Stevie Wonder, all the old Motown records.
Man.
So that was when the bug bit me for sure, like when I was like third grade, 8, 9 years old.
That's amazing, man. Now, how did you go from that to actually gigging? Like, what was your, what was the, you know, the first gig that you did maybe, or how did you get into the scene, quote unquote?
Well, you know, like I did junior high band.
Yeah.
So that was like the next step. And then in high school, I was really into like marching band. So like I got really into drums because, well, when I was 10, I got a guitar. And then my dad was an amateur drummer, so we always had drums around the house. So I learned both of them growing up. I learned how to play a little bit of guitar and drums. But then in high school, like, I started getting really into drums. And then I met Roland and the Gahate family, and then it kind of like escalated from there. But I think the first gig I did is, I think we like played at a cafe, like my freshman or sophomore year of college. We would just like casually play jazz music at a cafe. I remember that being like one of the first gigs I ever did. And I was just like, oh man, this is fun. And I'm actually making some money playing music. Because this is weird. I never thought I could do this. I never thought you could make money from playing a musical instrument.
Isn't that a trip? And especially at that age, like you're talking about, you know, you could go out and make $50, $75, $100 in one night, mm-hmm. as, you know, as a young teenager. And, you know, your buddies who are doing a newspaper route, it takes them a week to earn that much money, you know?
Yeah, I remember when I was in high school, I worked at Target. Right. And, you know, you work all week, like 20 hours, and then like I see my check is like $150. I was like, So after like doing a gig where you're like playing with your buddies for like 3 hours, you make $100. It's like you never want to turn back, you know?
It's a trip, man. It's so true. So true. Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. So, okay, like I said, going back to your resume, I love the fact that you've done a lot of TV work, some movie work. And you know, some, of course, like we said, the orchestral work. But now, as Eric said, and you were talking about earlier, you play both drum kit, classical percussion, and Latin percussion, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what are some of the things, like, tell us a day in the life of Stevie Ray Hernandez, when you were coming up and practicing and making sure that you touched on all those things, so you can be as versatile as you are today. You know, what was your routine or your schedule like? How did you manage that?
Honestly, like, it came in waves. Like, there were like some months where I was really into just playing timpani. So then I just practiced timpani for like a month and not really focus on much else.
Smart. And then, so you were immersing yourself in
mm-hmm.
yeah.
And then there would be like months in college, I remember, where all I wanted to play was conga drum. And then like my teachers would get upset with me because then I wouldn't practice like my assignments for my lessons, because all I was doing was playing like wah wah ko in the practice rooms.
I love that.
That was good too.
So like, that was the thing for me. Like I would focus on different things at different times, but like everything's kind of related, especially like when you're playing with sticks, like keeping your rudiments up and like just on a pad, like will filter into everything, you know. Mm. It'll filter into your drum set playing. It'll filter into like if I had to play xylophone or like timpani, timbale playing. So I would always make sure to have a good foundation with like just keeping my chops up on like playing like rudiments and like basic stuff like that.
Right. Mm. That's awesome. So look, versatility, you know, education, and then just perseverance. Right, those are three ingredients to having a successful career, I believe, in the music business. Mm-hmm. But what most people want to know, you know, and let's talk about maybe the young kids coming up in middle America or anywhere around the globe who don't live in Los Angeles. What they want to know is, how the hell do I break into the scene and get a real gig? You know, so mm-hmm. It's so funny because I've been asked this question countless times. And there is no real formula. It's not like we could say, well, X plus Y equals gigs, you know. Mm-hmm. But tell us about how you broke into the scene again with your orchestral background, your R&B and pop artist, you know, Kelly Clarkson, John Legend, Michael Bublé, you know, Daddy Yankee, Luis Fonsi, you know, I mean, the list goes on. And then the TV shows, American Idol, Dancing with the Stars. How did you really break into the scene and how did you manage to get into that upper echelon of working musicians?
You know, I always thought about this, and for me, it was always just like relationships and like friendships. And like, I always tell people, like, if you want to do a certain type of gig, like, kind of like investigate and see like who are the people that are doing this gig. Mm-hmm. And it's try to befriend these people, and but it's like the hardest thing is like, how do I become friends with these people genuinely as opposed to like forcing a friendship, you know? That's the hardest thing to like learn how to balance. That I mean sometimes I feel like I'm good with it, and sometimes I feel like I struggle with it, but I'm sure like every musician feels that way at some point. But
absolutely. Right? We've all been there.
Yeah, it's like every day.
Yeah.
But for me, it's always been, yeah, like developing relationships with people. And the orchestral scene is kind of different because a lot of that scene comes from like, it's almost like an apprenticeship. Like the people that you study with kind of bring you into the scene.
That's so right. That makes
developing
sense.
Like relationships with the people that are doing the jobs and like in the orchestras, like almost becoming like their apprentice and developing like a teacher student relationship. And like, I have always found like that in that scene, that's kind of like the way it works. Right. And from what I've seen, I mean, maybe other people have seen different things.
No, that makes perfect sense. And I'm glad you said the R word. The relationships, because honestly, that's what it's all about. And, you know, again, I'm always cognizant of our listeners who don't live in LA or New York or Nashville, who want to come to these cities and really take a stab at their career. We can't stress enough that the relationship is where it all stems from. It has mm-hmm. to, it kind of has to be organic, which I know sucks because that takes time, right?
Yeah.
You know.
That's always been a really hard thing for a lot of people I've seen, is like developing these relationships, but making it organic to the point where like, oh yeah, this person is really my friend and I can trust them, you know?
Right. Right. So, well, trust is another big element, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Talk about the difference, again, going back to your versatility, talk about maybe the mental preparation or even the technical preparation going from an orc gig to a pop gig. You know, you're jamming with Luis Fonsi on one on one night, you know, and doing an orchestra date with John Williams conducting the next night. You know, I mean, boy, how do you prepare?
I'm trying to think. Like last year, I was all over the place. Like in 1 week, I did a session, and then I was at the Coco rehearsals all week, and then right before the Coco concert, I was at a TV show rehearsal, like pop band rehearsal all day. So it's really weird. Like I've just gotten so used to like changing hats for different things that I don't even think about it anymore.
I love it. I love it. I love it. We're going to have to make that. We're going to have to firm that one up. You got to change hats. That's what it's all about, right?
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I guess I've just gained so much experience the last decade. Like, it's not really something I think about too much anymore. But I do know, like, for me, like, when I go to like an orchestral type gig, the best thing for me is to show up as early as I can and make sure, like, I'm situated with all the gear, and then like also make sure that I get a chance to like read through the music and know what's coming before I actually, they press record and you actually have to play, you know?
Right. Do you try to read through it? Well, I guess, you know, oftentimes you don't get the music at home. Probably you just get it right on set, right?
Yeah. Especially for like, if you're doing a TV or like movie session, like that stuff, usually you show up and you got to play it.
Yeah. Talking about being in the hot seat.
I know.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah. So for like the TV stuff, like I just make sure that, before I get to the gig, I am very familiar with the tunes that we're going to play. And then I usually like, I have an iPad, so I map out on the charts, like I'm going to play congas in this section or like tambourine in this section, just so I have a general idea of like what I'm doing on that gig. And then for like an orchestral gig, I just make sure I show up early enough to like look through the music and make sure I know what's coming, so I'm not too surprised when I get there, you know?
Right, right. You also said something that is so important about showing up early. You know, I believe, it's funny, I say this almost every freaking episode, you know, early is on time mm-hmm. and late, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like, if your downbeat's at 2:00 and you get there at 1:45, you're screwed, buddy. You know?
Yeah. It's funny that you say that, because I realized last year, because from like the movie scoring session scene, like, there's a scene of guys who do that work as far as percussion goes. Right. And what I realized is like, they have like these unwritten rules that I'm still learning about. And one of them is like, make sure if you're a percussionist, be there an hour early, because you got to set up a bunch of gear.
Yep.
And you got to go through parts, and your section leader has to like assign you what part you're going to play.
That's right.
So yeah, I mean, it's funny, like in these different scenes, there's all these different things that you learn as you gain experience. Like what, okay, what do I do in this situation? Or like, what is my role in this section? And, or what is, like, how early am I supposed to be at this gig, you know? It's just, you know, just with experience, you gain knowledge, you know?
Absolutely. And one of the things I like to tell people who haven't done the TV or film work yet, actually, it really doesn't matter what kind of work, but especially when you're going on to the lots, like if you're going to the NBC lot or, you know, the Sony stages or whatever, there's security you have to get through. There's parking, there's designated parking that's usually very far away from the studio that you're actually working in. So, mm-hmm. you know, if your downbeat's at 2 and you need to be there at 1, that means you need to be on the premise by 12:30.
Yeah.
Had that. So between 12:30 and 1, you can go through security, get your badge and your clearance, find your parking, right? And then actually be in the studio by 1, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, LA, if it's, you know, if 12:30 you need to be on prep, and depending where you live, you might need to leave at 11, you know? And you don't downbeat is until 2, but you're leaving your house at 11. You know what? Here's what I would say. It's better to be relaxed and acclimated to the environment than rushing, right?
Yeah, for sure. That's one thing that I've learned for sure is like just leaving super early, like, and getting there super early, like you're so much more relaxed when you actually have to play, like you play better.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you're like way early, let's say you get there and there's nobody there and clear security won't clear you yet. Go down the street to a Starbucks, right? You know?
Yeah.
At least you're in the vicinity. You're really close.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are my tricks.
Hi, I'm Stevie Ray Hernandez and I'm a career musician.
Being a career musician is more than just gigs and sessions. Are you a career musician? Find out on the Career Musician Podcast, streaming everywhere.
Blasting the stereotype of musicians. Follow us at the Career Musician Podcast.
Yeah, man. Hey, check it out. Do you have a mantra that you tell yourself when things get crazy? When you're in that hot seat, do you say, you know, is there something that you mumble, like, you know, internally?
You know what's funny is like, you guys are gonna laugh at this, but like, I'm a big Dodgers fan, right? And a couple years ago, there was a player on the team. His name was Alex Verdugo, and he was a rookie. And I remember seeing him like a couple times. He came into they brought him up into the game, and he killed it. And he was totally like one of the most confident guys on the field and like total rookie. And I remember like this last couple of years, whenever I felt like I was in the hot seat or I was under the gun, I'd always tell myself like, be like Alex Verdugo.
See?
Alex Verdugo.
See? That's perfect. That's not like a spoken mantra, but that's a mental imagery. Mm-hmm. You know, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's excellent. So, you know, during this pandemic, it's been difficult for musicians, especially. It's been difficult for everybody, but have you been able to do some work, you know, this year?
I've done a couple things, just like little casuals here and there that pop up, and then some home recording stuff.
Good.
And then a couple sessions and at like outside studios, and then I did a couple TV things, and that's about it. But so it's been you know, pretty slim pickings compared to 2019.
Right.
Yeah.
But set up at home. You have a home studio then?
Yeah, I got stuff going on here, and then I also record out of me and my friend have like a little studio thing going on in Woodland Hills. It's my British drummer buddy. It's Shabby Road Studios.
Shabby Road Studio?
Shabby Road, yeah.
I like that. Now, is this a private studio just for you guys, or is it a project studio that you actually have clients?
It's just a private studio, and then just record tracks out of there whenever, as needed, if people hit us up, you know?
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. What's your preferred DAW? Are you using Pro Tools, Logic, Ableton?
I'm using Logic right now.
Oh, okay. Wow. Yeah. And at home, how do you set up? Do you have a bunch of mics and pre's and everything?
I mean, I have like a handful of mics here. And then at Shabby Road, my buddy has a lot of nice pre's and mics going on there.
There you go.
Mainly, like, I have a couple of Neumann condensers that I use here for, like, hand percussion and mallets. If I need to do like drum set stuff, I'll go to his space.
Nice, nice.
Where do you find that you're recording the most?
Oh, that's a good question.
Like
right now?
Of all the things that you play or in the percussion section, you know, like what are you getting the most?
I probably record like tambourine, conga, and shaker the most. Out of anything.
Let's talk about that. That is perfect. Tambourine, conga, and shaker. So first of all, omit the congas. Tambourine and shaker. That is a trip, you know, because people think, man, I'm going to be a drummer and a percussionist, and I'm going to play all these wicked cool instruments, and I'm going to be so amazing. And then you get hired to do this. I love that because that's such an interesting dichotomy.
Yeah, I think I play tambourine, especially on the TV stuff, play tambourine more than anything.
Bro, come on, dude. You're making money playing tambourine and shaker.
Like, I know. It's awesome. I love
it. Who else can say that, right? Besides percussionists.
I'm supposed to show you how serious the tambourine is.
That's right. And I'm not laughing because those are by no means am I implying those are easy instruments to play. Sure, anybody can pick it up and shake it and make a sound. But to play it well and stay in that pocket, that's actually hard.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different tricks to the tambourine. And I'm still learning a lot of stuff about it. But especially like that Motown stuff, like a lot of the gospel tambourine, like that stuff's pretty wild if you get into it.
Right. But, and the tambourine with the skin on it so you can bounce it on your other hand.
Yeah. And even like, because like I play orchestral music, orchestral tambourines, it's its own thing too. Totally different technique than any of the other stuff.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And what's the Brazilian version of that? What is it, the bandera?
Pandeiro?
Bandeiro, yeah, pandeiro, yeah. That's interesting too, right?
Yeah, I play a little bit of that. I definitely have some friends that are way better at that than I am, that are Brazilians.
Right.
But I can get by with it, but it's definitely not my bag. There's some people who are pretty amazing at that instrument.
Absolutely, absolutely, man. I mean, you know, if you have people from that who are natives from that area or who studied, mm-hmm. it makes sense. It makes sense. So again, going back to the TV and film work, you have to be a member of the union in order to do a lot of those gigs. Talk about that.
Well, the union, like, let's see, I joined the union maybe around 10 years ago, and I only joined because I was, like, pretty fresh out of college, and I got a gig sidelining on that TV show, Chuck. You remember that show? I was the bongo player on a scene from that show.
Nice.
And, that was like one of my first gigs, like being sidelining on a TV show. And they made me join the union to do it. Right. And it's weird because there's a lot of different gigs. Like you don't have to be a member of the union to do like, you know, a lot of sessions, like they don't monitor. It'd be like pretty impossible for them to monitor all these different sessions that are going on at home studios.
Right.
But a lot of the major film and TV work is all union. So yeah, you're going to have to join up for that stuff. But I would say to like younger musicians, like don't join until you have to.
Right.
Because you get to do one union gig a year without having to join. So always remember that.
But that's a good point. But I always say once you're locked in, and you're in that scene and you're earning money on union gigs, it's really a great thing because the benefits are amazing with, you know, the sound recording special payments.
Oh, yeah.
Secondary market film fund, the SAG-AFTRA AFM funds, right?
Yeah, I mean, all that stuff's really nice. Like, that's why doing movie sessions is so coveted because you get all that back end.
That's right.
Especially if you end up playing on like a major film, like a John Williams Star Wars score or something, like, yeah, you're gonna make a lot more money on the back end than you did recording the actual session
on the date. That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so funny because some of the movies that I've done 10 years ago, I'm still seeing those residuals for. So,
yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm getting rich off of it, but there are people, like you said, in the LA film and TV scene who have done very well based on their resumes, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, that. I guess that check for the movies comes around every July.
Yes.
And I've heard stories of, like, you know, people showing up every July to, like, sessions with, like, new cars.
Yeah. or buying a new house.
Yeah,
it's the movie check comes in July. The sound recording special payment, which you get from playing on albums, that comes in August.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the SAG-AFTRA AFM comes in June. So you have, like, 3 months there that you can just know, okay, great. I hope my royalty and my residuals are going to be good, you know? But it's important. Like you said, it's important for people to know this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So listen, you've done a lot. You're still young. You have a whole career ahead of you. How do you define success?
How do I define success? I don't know. That's been changing for me recently. Like, used to be doing, like, certain gigs that I wanted to do for a long time. That's how I would define, like, being successful. Like, right. For me, like, some of the gigs that I always wanted to do were, like, play, like, since I was in junior high, I wanted to play with the LA Phil. And I ended up playing with the LA Phil for a summer. And, you know, for me, that made me feel rather successful as a musician, as a percussionist, you know?
Yeah.
And then, one of the artists I always wanted to play with was Sarah Bareilles.
Yes.
And, I ended up on a gig with her. She was singing The Little Mermaid. I ended up playing the percussion section for that. So something like that made me feel really successful, like completing, like, a goal that I, or like a dream gig that I set out to do. But
I love that.
I don't know. It's been kind of shifting. I think more now is just like what music makes me happy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So like lately, like, but I mean, pre-pandemic, I was putting on my own shows in town. Like I was putting on I do a Jeff Buckley night.
Nice.
Once a year. And we do the whole Grace album, every track from the Grace album. And I have, like, guest singers come up and sing each track. And then I also would put on, like, a 60s prom show.
That's the shit right there. I used to go watch them do that.
Really?
Yeah, it was, like, my favorite. Everybody would dress up like the 60s.
So I started realizing doing stuff like that was making me feel more fulfilled than, like, playing like a crazy movie session date or something, you know?
Right.
So I think it was just because I was surrounded by musicians that I really liked. I handpicked everyone that played.
And so you would just invite people to be a part of the band?
Yeah. And then the audience really dug it. Like Eric said, like, everyone showed up, like, dressed in 60s attire, like the Jeff Buckley night. I remember people were coming up to me after the show and, like, crying because they've never heard Jeff's music in person, you know?
Wow.
And I tried to do all the songs as true to the record as possible.
Were you singing and playing guitar, or were you playing drums and percussion?
Whenever I would do my 60s nights, like, I was playing drums. For the Jeff Buckley show, I was playing guitar.
Nice,
and music directing. So I don't know, those things, doing things like that made me feel a little bit more fulfilled than being a freelancer at the moment, you know? Like, so is my thought of success has been shifting, you know? Like, what is gonna make me feel more fulfilled now as, like, a musician?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I'm at a very similar place, and it's good to be at that place.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe for the first part of your career, if your goal is to be a career musician, it's a little bit more difficult to do that. You have to just really focus on getting the gigs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, once you've established that, then doing other things for fun and a creative outlet, that's so important.
Yeah. So, yeah, I agree.
So it sounds like that's almost like words of wisdom that you would give somebody pursuing your path, huh?
I guess so.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never been one to like tell people like, oh, you need to do things this way. But I guess those, like if I had to tell like the my younger self that,
right,
you know, that would be what I would say.
Yeah. What would you tell 19-year-old Stevie Ray Hernandez? You know, right?
I would say, don't be afraid to fail.
I love that.
Yeah.
So true.
Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to like fall on your face.
Man, I feel like I fail every day, but I'm actually learning, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm, yeah, little failures, little things that just don't work out. Like, oh, okay, now I get it. Now I'll try this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there was a lot of times like when I was younger, I'd be afraid to do things and I just wouldn't do them just because, you know, you're just so afraid,
right,
of like failing, like taking an audition or,
right,
you know, maybe like trying out a different school or,
yeah,
you know, go sitting in at a certain gig, you know.
I'm glad you said that. Sitting in was always one of those things for me. They're like, I don't want to go sit in. There's going to be so many guys that'll, you know, shred me to pieces, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then every time I said that, but I actually went and sat in, I had the most amazing time, you know.
Yeah.
Right? You just got to do it.
Yeah. So, yeah, that I'm telling my, I would tell my young selves, like you said, you just got to do it.
Yeah.
Just go for it.
I love that, man. Hey, Stevie, before we wrap, let's do some rapid fire questions.
All right.
All right. So Eric and I have worked out this little routine here. He made me cue cards, which, by the way, I got to say, I like this little team we have, this little duet. Has anybody told you that you look a lot like Jimmy Fallon?
Really?
You've never heard that one before?
Actually, yeah, I get that all the time.
Ah, okay. You're pulling my leg. Thank you. Thank you. I like it. Hey, it's showbiz. That is awesome.
I mean, yeah, I used to get that all the time. Maybe like five. Especially when he first started his show, when he was like in the limelight a bunch. Like,
yeah.
I used to get that all the time. Like, hey, you remind me of somebody.
Bro, it took me like the first 5 minutes to figure it out internally. And then I was like, I got it. But I also think it's the angle of the screen that you're looking at us on. You know, it looks like it's a little angled down. I don't know. Anyway, hey, that's not a bad thing, bro. All right. So are we ready for the rapid? So we're going to give you 1 minute. Tell them the rules, Eric G.
All right. You get 1 minute and you can try to answer as many questions as you can.
And okay. Check it out. I got a stack of cards here, baby. Look at that. I got a stack of cue cards that Eric G made me. So, whew. All right. I'm all nervous. I shouldn't be nervous. I'm asking, not telling.
So I got 1 minute.
I'll tell you when you're at the 10 second mark.
Okay. Right. You ready? Yeah. Count us down from 10.
All right. 3, 2, 1, go.
Musical guilty pleasure.
Taylor Swift.
Top 3 artists in your playlist.
Sarah Bareilles, Jeff Buckley, John Lennon.
3 gig essentials.
Let's see. Styx. Oh man, this is hard. Styx, snacks, and a phone to read.
What entertains you?
A vinyl player.
Your friends would say you are blank.
Crazy.
Studio or live?
Studio.
Alcoholic or non-alcoholic?
Alcoholic.
Instrument you wish you played?
Piano.
Piano. Favorite restaurant?
And I forgot to give you the 10.
But we got to get a buzzer.
Yeah, I know. We're working it out.
Favorite restaurant.
Favorite restaurant. I don't really have one. I guess I like Mambo's Cafe.
Mambo's, hey. Which reminds me, tell us before we wrap, tell us about the Gahate story at Mambo's. Eric G was just filling me in a little bit. I want to hear it from you. What really happened that night at Mambo's?
No, I was just telling him about the way we were dressed.
Oh, with the rainbow vest?
Yeah.
So Richie, the dad, has this he has an old VHS, like an instructional DVD, or not DVD, VHS,
right.
Through LP.
That's Richie Gahate.
Richie Gahate.
The father of Roland Gahate. Yeah.
And I guess the mom thought it was a funny idea to make the whole band wear these rainbow vests. So we did a concert at Mambo's and we did Richie's album. And I thought it was funny. I was like, I told Tristan, I was like, the brother, I was like, dude, you got to find those vests. We got to wear them. So they found them and we all wore the vest and we brought it back.
That's awesome, man. I love that. I used to love going to Mambo's just to listen to the Latin jams, but it is sad that they don't do the music anymore.
I know, man. It's a bummer.
Myself, I'm half Cuban. My father's from Cuba. And so I got the Latino gene, and this guy right here and I, we've been working out some things. So we'd love to get you involved as well. So hopefully we'll be able to call you for some session work soon.
Yeah, that'd be great, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you for being on The Career Musician. I forgot to ask you the last question. What would you do if you weren't a career musician?
I would probably be either a lawyer or an engineer. Because when I was in high school, I really liked to argue with my teachers. So they always said I would be a good lawyer. And then I always liked building stuff. And I liked math and science. So like, I always had an interest in being like a mechanical engineer.
You sound like a ridiculously smart and talented person.
Thanks, man.
That's awesome, bro. Man, thank you so much for being our guest, Stevie.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. Yeah. I appreciate this.
Good to see you.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.